Well, I certainly would like to thank the elders for the opportunity to come and speak here. I enjoyed the opportunity I had a couple of years ago to speak in your series, and I hope that I did some good in that opportunity. And it's nice after that chance to be given such a simple topic as this one to come and speak on as why I believe in God. And it really is a very simple topic. It's a simple thing to answer because, you know, one Saturday morning a few years ago, I woke up and I thought to myself, you know, I don't really have anything good to do this weekend, so I think that I might just believe in God. And that was the extent of it. And that's why I believe in God, because I had nothing better to do one weekend than just to believe in God. Well, of course, that's absurd. But that's really the level of thought that most skeptics would attribute to a believer. That the reason that you have faith, the reason that you believe in God, is something as simple as deciding on a whim one weekend that you don't have anything better to do, and so because of that, you decided to believe in God. And that's the attribute of thought they would give you if they were being kind, many of them. Take, for example, what George Smith said in his book, Atheism, The Case Against God. He says, reason and faith are opposites, two mutually exclusive terms. There is no reconciliation or common ground. Faith is belief without or in spite of reason. Or what Charles Templeton said in his book, Farewell to God. Is it not foolish to close one's eyes to the reality that much of the Christian faith is simply impossible to accept as fact? One thing that I do want to make abundantly clear this evening is that this is simply not the case. In fact, this has probably been one of the more difficult lessons I've had to come up with in the last few years. And it's not because there's so little reason for believing in God, so much as it's because there is so much reason for believing in God. I had the opportunity last year to teach for the first time a class on evidences that ran for the entire semester. And in an entire semester's worth of time, I couldn't talk about everything that I wanted to talk about in terms of why it's reasonable and rational and sensible and a good thing and a right thing to believe in God. So obviously, in 40 minutes, I'm not going to be able to pull that off. And so the challenge then is how to choose from all of the material that's available what is the most convincing for you when you're speaking to your neighbor. What is the most applicable? What is the most easy to understand, not just for you, but for someone who's never really thought about God in these terms before? And so for that reason, we're going to be observing the Passover, so to speak, on some of the things that may be more traditional arguments that you may think of. You may be familiar with what is called the cosmological argument, which is a great philosophical argument for the existence of God, but it's the kind of thing that if your neighbor is asking you about God and they're not used to working their way through philosophy and logic, it's probably not the best route for you to take. Or you may be familiar with various design arguments from the intelligent design authors. And those are wonderful arguments as well. But the problem is, if you don't really know the science, you either have to rely on what someone else is telling you or try to explain it in such a way that your neighbor can understand the physics or the molecular biology or whatever else may go behind those arguments as well. And so while those have great value, they can be difficult to understand and they cannot sometimes be the most practical thing for dealing with your neighbors and why they're asking these questions. And so what I've chosen are two approaches. One, because I think it's very simple, it's universally understood, at least it should be, and is easy for you to discuss with your neighbor. And the other, because it is the most important thing behind our faith. And so that's kind of the approach we're taking and where we're going to be going. You can see kind of how I have it outlined there on the outline in front of you, and if you flip it over, you'll see there's a very short list of books. If you want to do any more reading into these kinds of things for you to start, and if not, then maybe it'll help you get the grill started this weekend or something. The first thing that we should do, however, before we get into those kinds of things and that sort of approach to the question of why we believe in God, is to take a step back from that and ask a question about the nature of faith itself. And obviously, if I don't have time to talk about everything in terms of why it's rational to believe in God, we don't have time to get into a full discussion of faith either. However, there are two points that I think need to be made when we're talking about faith, and especially when we're talking about rationally believing in God with our neighbors. Two points we need to make and understand what faith is, and more specifically, what faith is not, because these are two extremes that far too often are misunderstood by people. And the first of these is to say that faith is not a blind leap. And far too often when people talk about faith, they talk about faith in exactly these terms, that faith is a blind leap that someone takes. It's characterized as closing your eyes to reality. It's characterized as the opposite of reason. Just that quote that we saw a minute ago from George Smith, that reason and faith are two mutually exclusive terms, that faith is belief in spite of evidence. There are these two diametrically opposed entities out there. There is faith and there is reality. And those two things simply cannot exist at the same time because faith is the opposite of reality. And sadly, there are so-called people of faith who approach things this way as well, who come to difficult questions in their life, who come to troubles or conundrums in the Scripture, or when someone that they love suffers or dies. And what they say is, well, there are these difficult questions, and so I'll just ignore them and blindly accept God. My friends, that is not the faith of the Bible. That is not at all a biblical picture of the kind of faith God wants us to have. There are countless examples of reasoning and considering and making logical, sound argumentation. You may think about Jesus as he reasoned with the elders in the temple, or how he later taught with authority. You may think of Peter's first sermon where he calls his audience to carefully consider his words, or the Bereans who carefully examined the Scripture and weighed against Paul's teaching, or Paul himself and how he reasoned with the philosophical elite on Mars Hill. That is the biblical picture of faith, something that goes hand in hand with reasoning and considering and thinking. That's the biblical picture of faith. Faith and evidence are not two things that are diametrically opposed to one another according to Scripture, but there is a direct connection between them. It is not at all to be a blind leap. You may remember John and how he concludes his gospel with the story of Thomas, and how Thomas at first does not believe, but then when Jesus appears the second time and Thomas sees him for himself, he immediately believes and immediately confesses that Jesus is the Son of God. And that leads into John telling us why he wrote his gospel, which is to cause faith in those who do not see. The point is that the Bible is directing us to evidence for us to consider, for us to think about, for us to meditate about, and then come to a conclusion based on that evidence, not to take a blind leap. You may remember John the Baptist as he is in prison, and he has his momentary problem with his faith. And he sends his disciples to Jesus to ask them if Jesus was, in fact, the Messiah. And Jesus sends report back saying, John, what are you doing asking these questions? Just close your eyes to the evidence and take a leap of faith. That's what I want from you, John. Well, obviously, that's not what John does, or what Jesus does. He sends word back to John saying, look at the evidence and see what this leads you to believe. And then, of course, there are countless biblical warnings against gullibility. All the way back as Moses is writing the law for the people, then all the way to the time where John, the last apostle living, is nearing the end of his life, and he says, test the spirits to see if these things are so. Not blindly accept everything. Not close your eyes and take a leap of faith. Think about these things. Consider these things. Weigh these things. Meditate on these things. Consider the evidence, and then come to a conclusion based on that. On top of all of this, the humanists and scientists and materialists who speak so poorly about faith, every one of them lives by faith on their own. Just because someone takes a naturalistic approach to the world doesn't mean that he's a person who doesn't have faith. The reality is everyone has faith of some kind. And so to say that all faith is absurd and meaningless and a blind leap is something that even these people would not believe in their own lives. A great example of this is atheism itself. For starters, the entire evolutionary system is a faith-based belief. It has never been reproduced in a lab according to the scientific method, and every time that has been attempted, it has failed miserably. On top of that, the reality is that one simply cannot disprove the existence of God. It cannot be done. Honestly, the furthest someone could get, if they are honest with themselves, is to be an agnostic. To be someone who says, you know, I honestly don't know one way or the other. But the moment they say, I know God does not exist, they have taken a step of faith. Now, they may say they've proved that God doesn't exist because they've called on God to kill them if he did exist, but that just proves that God is not easily baited. If you take the hypothetical circumstance where if this atheist had the opportunity to travel the entire universe and look everywhere that God could possibly be to find God, if he could do that and he took that trip and looked everywhere in the universe and found God nowhere in it, that still would not prove that God doesn't exist. It just may prove that God was one step ahead of him the entire trip, that he was in a part of the universe where God was not. In fact, to prove that God does not exist somewhere in this universe in a visible form, one would have to be at every place in the universe at the exact same time. In short, he would have to be God to prove that God does not exist. But beyond that, we all live by faith because we trust that people are who they say they are. We trust that we can rely on our senses, that the information the eyes are bringing into our brain is an accurate portrayal of what is really happening out there. We trust our memories, and on down the line we could go. We all live by faith of some kind, and it is all reasoned faith. And I would suggest to you that biblical faith is exactly the same thing. Well, the other extreme that people sometimes go to when they consider faith is, well, it's not a blind leap. I don't want to get into something I don't know anything about, and so then I have to have all of the answers before I can believe in God. I can't make a commitment to him. I can't really put my trust in him until I have all of the answers to all of the questions that I could possibly have. And this simply is not realistic, and this is not a picture of biblical faith as well. It is not having all of the answers. Although it is based on rational evidence, it is not to be equated with knowledge. In fact, the moment that we experience something in such a way that we know it, we can no longer have faith about it because we know it. The example that I like to give of this is I could tell you this evening that I have my car keys in my pocket. And you could have faith in my statement that they are there. And you could have faith for a number of good reasons. My car is outside, so it's natural to presume I would have keys. And most men keep their keys in their pocket, at least at some point, so that's another good reason. And I could stand up here and jingle them a little bit, and there's more evidence. You haven't seen them, you don't know that they're there, but you could have faith that they are there. And then I could completely take that faith away. And you may think I would take that faith away by pulling out a handful of change and say, no, the jingle was coins, it wasn't my keys, the keys are back there on the pew with my wife. Or I could take away your faith by showing you that I do, in fact, have keys in my pocket, and now you know they are there, so you can no longer have faith that they are there. Faith is something that is different from knowledge. It cannot coexist with full knowledge. And this is the biblical picture as well. That's why the author of Hebrews talks about faith being in relation to things that are hoped for and things that are not seen. It's why Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5 that we walk by faith and not by sight. Or after he finishes his great discussion on love in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 13, he talks about the three things that are enduring, faith and hope and love, but only one of those things will remain. The other two will be done away with, and one of those is faith. I don't know if you've ever thought about that before, but that's not something we typically picture in terms of faith. It is something that is temporal. Faith is something that is going to go away completely one day. Well, how is it that faith is going to go away? Well, it will go away when it is replaced by sight. When we have experienced God in heaven, when we have seen him with our eyes, we will no longer need to have faith in him in the same way. And the reality is that there simply will be things that we never know the answer to in this life. There will be moments when we need to make a conscious decision about something that we cannot see, about something that we don't have the answer to. But what I want to suggest to you is that even this, even when we don't have the answers and we need to take a step out there with our faith, this is not a blind leap. Because we respond here in faith, not on a whim. We respond based on the evidence that undergirds the rest of our relationship with God. We've seen the evidence. We know God is there. We've put our trust in Him. And so when we have to take a step out somewhere where we don't know the answers, that's not a blind leap. That's just trusting in God based on the rest of the evidence that we have seen. Well, that's two points I think that are helpful to examine in terms of what faith is, or more precisely perhaps what faith is not, when we come to ask the question of why we believe in God. And I suppose there are a variety of ways we could approach this question. We've already talked about some of the other evidential ways of approaching it. And I suppose there are ways that this can be approached without thinking in terms of evidences. That's just not the way my mind thinks. And since I was chosen to speak on this, you're trapped within the limitations of my mind. So I apologize for that. But the first thing that I would suggest to you is a very good reason to believe in God. And the kind of thing that you can speak to your neighbor about without having to be, you know, a PhD in philosophy, without having to follow complicated logical steps, without having to be a great scientific mind, is to tell your neighbor you believe in God because there is moral law in the world. There is a universal moral law. There is a universal moral standard that we all live by. Well, how do we know that such a thing as a universal moral law really is out there? It's not written down anywhere. It's not a law like gravity where people have to obey it. In fact, people very often break this moral law. So how do we know that it is really there and we really have to believe it? Let me suggest to you one way we know that it is there is the problem of evil. The problem of evil, if you're not familiar with it, is one of the things that skeptics very often use to combat Christianity. It's one of their great arguments to try to prove that God does not exist. It goes something like this: because evil exists, God cannot, at least the way that Christians would define God. Because if God was all good and God was all powerful, then evil simply would not be there. And that can be a very difficult thing to answer. That can be a difficult question to think through. But on the other side of that, this ultimately points to the existence of this moral standard. Because when someone says evil is a problem, innocent children starving to death, that is an evil, and we can all look at that and say that's an evil, and why does God let something like that happen? The other side of that question is, on what basis is it evil? Why is it that everybody across the world looks at a starving child and says, this is an evil, terrible, terrible thing? Why is it that we all react that way? I don't want to minimize this difficult issue of the problem of evil, but understand that if there is no God, there is no standard by which something can be judged, good or evil, and so it is no longer a problem. And then there are some historical evils, things that have happened in history that are universally acknowledged as evil. Of course, the classic example of this is the Holocaust. And again, the question is, what makes this evil? What makes this such a bad thing to have happened? If there is no ultimate standard by which we can hold it up and say this is either good or it is bad, if there is no such standard, then it's only evil because it's something we didn't happen to care for. Kind of like Brussels sprouts might be evil because we don't happen to care for those. But of course, we all understand that Brussels sprouts and the Holocaust are not at all in the same category. Well, why is that? Why is it that everyone across the world, except for the occasional sociopath, understands that the Holocaust was evil? And children who starve to death, that's an evil thing. What is the sense in saying that the Holocaust was wrong unless right is a real thing? That deep down the Nazis knew as well as we do, and they knew they ought to have practiced. If they had no notion of right, If the Nazi people had no idea what right really was, then you know we probably still would have had to go to war to stop them from what they were doing, but we couldn't have blamed them for what they were doing any more than we could blame them for the color of their hair, or we could blame a pack of wolves for killing a flock of sheep. Because if right isn't a real thing that everyone knows, then by definition, the Holocaust wasn't wrong. This is one of the arguments that C.S. Lewis makes in his book, Mere Christianity, the moral argument. And he looks at it on a smaller level as well as these big kinds of ways of thinking about it. And he talks about an expectation of fair play, an expectation of morality, a decent behavior in our fellow human beings. And one of the ways that he shows evidence of this is when we criticize each other for acting wrongly. And we say things like, "How'd you like it if someone did that to you?" Or, "That's my seat, I was there first." Or, "You can't cut in line." Or, "Give me a piece of your orange, I gave you a piece of mine." Or, "You promised that you would do such and such a thing." Now, every time someone says something like this, and we've all said this kind of thing before, we've all heard it before, when we say this, we're not saying that the behavior doesn't happen to please us at the moment. What we're saying, what we're implying, we may not even realize it, but what we're really saying is that there is some kind of standard of behavior that we expect the other person knows about. And we expect that person understands that standard of behavior. And the response is never, "Well, forget your standard, you're making up a law I don't live by. I don't follow that same set of laws of behavior that you follow." No, what we all do when we're faced in this situation is we pretend that there's some special reason why in this particular case the standard doesn't apply to us. That there's some reason why the person who took the seat first shouldn't have the seat now. Or there were different circumstances when I gave you my segment of orange than when now I want yours. Or something that has turned up that keeps us or lets us off from having to keep our promises. In short, what we're doing is we're defending our wrong actions with excuses. We never deny that the rules are really there. And of course, that's the reality of it, is that none of us actually keep this moral law the way that we should. All of us have at some point failed to practice the kind of behavior that we expect from other people. And we all probably have a litany of excuses as to why we haven't done so. And again, the issue here isn't whether or not those are legitimate excuses, but that in the very fact we make excuses about it betrays the fact that we understand how we should be behaving. You see, we believe in decency so much that we can't bear the fact that we're breaking this standard, and so we try to shift the responsibility. And so again, what we see, whether we're talking about something big like the problem of evil, or something terrible like the Holocaust, or even something as simple as making excuses for our poor conduct in daily life, we all understand that there is some moral law out there that we should all be following. Well, at this point, someone may say, what about the moral relativist? What about those people out there who say there is no such thing as absolute morality? Those people who say there is no such thing as objective truth. What is good for you is not necessarily good for me. What is true for you is not necessarily true for me. What about those people? Well, the reality with those people is that that is the kind of thing that may sound good when they're sitting around amongst themselves talking about moral relativism. And it may sound good when they're talking about other people. But the reality is when push comes to shove and it comes down to them and their lives, moral relativism isn't really believed even by the people who espouse it. No one is really a moral relativist to this point. Well, sure, they'll happily defend their lying to you by saying they don't believe in right and wrong. But as soon as you lie to them, well, suddenly someone has done something terrible that needs to be accounted for. They may say criminals have done things for a variety of reasons other than they're bad people. But if someone breaks into their house and steals their property, then suddenly this person needs to be locked up for what they have done. They may say people are free to live their lives how they want and choose to love who they want the way they want. But the moment someone sleeps with their wife, then someone is a cad and a terrible, terrible person. You see, this is a nice theory, perhaps, for people who want to talk about it in relation to other people. But no one really believes this. And the same thing is true with those people who say they don't believe in objective truth, that what is true for you is not necessarily true for me. If you took a classroom of USF students who have bought into that postmodern nonsense and sent them to my class, and I flunked them all because my objective truth that day was that test answers written in blue crayon weren't right, suddenly objective truth would be a very good thing for those people. And their answers were right in spite of what color there was written in. Because you don't really believe this kind of thing in practice. The reality is there is a universal moral law. We do understand right and wrong and good and bad. And the reason is because there is an objective standard. There is something that we can hold every action, every decision up against that standard and say, is this good or is this bad? Well, what is that? Where does this universal standard come from? Well, first of all, evolution cannot explain it. There is no possible way that biological evolution, as suggested by Charles Darwin and expanded since then, there is no way natural selection explains universal understanding of moral law. On top of that, and this is where, if you want to look more into this, I would refer you back to C.S. Lewis' book, because he talks about these next elements in much more detail. It is not herd instinct, and it is not merely a matter of a convenient choice, and it is not social convention either. Where then does this universal moral standard come from? Well, the answer is the simplest one that there can be. God made man in His image and in His likeness. There is a universal standard of good because there is an eternal holy God. And that is the only thing that can explain it. It is in everyone because we were all made in His image. That's why we can look at the Holocaust and say this was an evil, deplorable thing. Because God is there and God sits in judgment over what Hitler did. That's why we can look at children starving and say this is a terrible thing that this is happening. Because it is not what God created. It is not what God intended for mankind. We have that standard to measure it by. And it is only the existence of God that provides an answer to this question. Well, the other line of reasoning that I would suggest in terms of speaking with your neighbor may not be the easiest to work your way through, perhaps, but it is the most important. And it is the fact that Jesus of Nazareth rose from the dead. Again, the time that we have this evening does not permit a full study of resurrection evidence. But this is the crux of the matter. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 that it is of first importance. He goes on to tell us that if Jesus did not rise from the dead, then we're all still in our sins, our faith is completely worthless, and we're the most pitiful group of people on the planet. This is what everything hinges on. If Jesus rose from the dead, it verifies the God of the Bible. It verifies Christianity. And the rest of the questions then are merely academic. This comes to the point where we can look at the evidence concerning Jesus and His resurrection, and we can say confidently, I know that Jesus rose from the dead. And so where there are other difficult questions and I don't know the answer to, I can take that step of faith out there because I know God raised Jesus from the dead, and that's enough answer for me. This evening, for the sake of time, we're going to take something of an abbreviated approach to the resurrection. But it's something of a very valuable approach to the resurrection as well. It seems to be becoming more in vogue in those who defend the resurrection. It's called the minimal facts approach. And these are the things that are agreed upon by basically everybody. Even people who don't believe in the resurrection believe that these things are true. And again, that's not to say you won't find your complete wacko out there who just denies everything and will deny these as well. But people who have honestly studied the evidence, even if they don't believe in God, even if they don't believe in the resurrection, they will believe in these five facts. First, Jesus died by crucifixion. Second, Jesus' disciples believed that he rose and that he appeared to them. Third, the church persecutor Paul was suddenly changed. Fourth, the skeptic James, the brother of Jesus, was suddenly changed. And fifth, the tomb was empty. Now again, these are the minimal facts. If we had a lot of time this evening, we could go into great detail talking about a variety of other evidences there are that some people will believe in and some people won't, and some of the skeptics might accept and some of them won't, that we could just add just a lot of evidence to this as well. But these are the minimal facts. And the question is, even with just these five small pieces of evidence, what is there as a solution that will answer these questions or this testimony? What is there out there that we could point to and say, here is a solution to the testimony that we have that explains why this evidence is out there? And what we'll do this evening is something you've probably done at some point in your life before, which is to take a brief tour of some of the other solutions that have been proposed by other people through the years. First, there is what is the oldest theory, which is the stolen body theory. This is the oldest because it goes all the way back to Matthew chapter 28, when the soldiers went to the leaders that first time and they said, tell the people that someone stole his body. And it's still around even to this day. This problem is really threefold. Even before we get to these minimal facts, there are three pretty big problems with this approach to the resurrection evidence. First of all, there's the problem of motive. What motivation did the disciples have to do this? Here's a group of people who were completely despondent. A group of people who have given up all hope. They were so disappointed. This person, they thought he had to be the Messiah. Suddenly, instead, he has been crucified. We've last seen them running for their lives. Now they're hiding behind locked doors. Is this a group of people that would have the motive to steal the body of Jesus? But even if we grant that for some reason they decided amongst themselves they're going to go try to steal the body of Jesus, they came up with some motivation for doing it, could they possibly execute the plan? Well, we have a ragtag group of fishermen and tax collectors and a zealot and the likes who are going to go together and attack trained Roman guards. No, they couldn't have executed this plan. Jesus didn't spend his time on earth making a Mission Impossible team out of his disciples. But even if somehow they overcame the obstacle of having no motivation whatsoever to do it, and they somehow managed to execute the plan and take out the Roman guards and steal the body of Jesus and hide it away somewhere, think about the logic now involved, that they're going to go around preaching that Jesus rose from the dead to the point that they are all tormented, tortured, and die for this teaching. Yes, it is true that people die for lies all the time. But none of those people die for a lie that they made up in the first place. They've been deceived and they believe the lie and so they die for it. None are the ones who say, here's a story I'm making up that I know is not true, and then they go suffer persecution the way that these men suffered persecution. No, this theory doesn't hold water even before we ask whether or not it answers the minimal facts. Well, does it answer the minimal facts? You look at these things that everybody believes. Well, maybe it explains why Jesus' disciples believed that he rose and that he appeared to them, if you want to call them making up a lie, a reason why they would believe that. And yes, it does explain why the tomb is empty. But there is no possible way that this theory explains why Paul goes from church persecutor to evangelist extraordinaire. There is no way this theory possibly explains why James goes from a skeptic to a believer. So even if you could somehow pass all of the logical and execution and motivation obstacles to this theory, it doesn't answer the facts that everyone acknowledges to be true. And so we turn our attention then to the next theory that others have posed over the years, and it is the wrong tomb theory. This is my favorite theory because it is probably the most silly of all. And it says that the first women there, that first resurrection morning, went to the wrong tomb, and that's why everyone believes in the resurrection, because it was just a big mix-up. These women, they went to the wrong place, they got all excited and ran back and told Peter and John they went to the wrong place too, and it's just a big mix-up, and that's really the crux of the matter. This, of course, is ridiculous. Now, if it had been men there first, then maybe they went to the wrong tomb, but we all know that the women, they would have stopped and asked for directions if they'd gotten lost. And so clearly they wouldn't have gone to the wrong tomb. And in fact, when you read the story in John, the first thing Mary does when she sees the tomb is empty is, "Where is he?" She does ask for directions. But aside from that, even if the women did get confused, let's say just for the sake of argument, they got lost. They went to the wrong tomb. Peter and John, they were excited. They went to the wrong tomb too. But then it starts to get absurd. The other nine apostles, they went to the wrong tomb as well. The Jewish leaders who were so intent on keeping Jesus' body there, they went to the wrong tomb. The Roman soldiers who were guarding the tomb, were they guarding the wrong tomb? Were they just down the aisle a little bit at the next tomb and, you know, the women didn't see him down there? What about Joseph of Arimathea? Did he forget where his own tomb was? This is a theory that solves one mystery by creating another mystery and doesn't work very well as a theory for that reason. On top of that, when you go back to the minimal facts, it doesn't explain why Jesus' disciples believed that Jesus rose and appeared to them. It doesn't explain why Paul was converted. It doesn't explain why Jesus was converted. And it might explain the empty tomb, but then it leaves open why no one eventually found the right tomb in the end. So this theory doesn't answer the evidence either. The next two theories are very closely related. One is the hallucination theory that says that the appearances of Christ were merely hallucinations. But again, here, if that's the case, the body is still in the tomb. And so when Peter is standing up on Pentecost saying that Jesus had risen from the dead, all the Jewish leaders had to do was go and gather his body and bring it and say, "Sorry, Peter, here's the corpse of Jesus. He hasn't risen from the dead. He's still just as dead as he was yesterday." On top of that, when you take into account what we know about hallucinations, this simply does not match the facts. Hallucinations are individualistic. There is no such thing at any point in history of a group hallucination where everyone hallucinated the exact same thing at the exact same time. Whether it's as small as a group of the two disciples who walked with Jesus to Emmaus, or the 500 who saw Jesus at once that Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 15, there is no such thing as a group hallucination, and so this does not work on that account. On top of that, it might explain why Paul and James were converted if they hallucinated too, but it doesn't explain the tomb being empty. And so this fails as well to explain the testimony. The vision theory is one like it, except instead of being crazy and hallucinating, the people had visions that God sent Jesus to comfort those who were mourning for him. And this is just patently absurd. Why is it that God can send a vision of Jesus, but he can't raise him from the dead? Here, we're really going to come up with a theory that replaces one miracle with another miracle and think that's going to solve something. And on top of that, then the tomb is still not empty, and so this simply cannot be the case. Well, finally then, is one you've probably heard the most about, is probably the most prevalent today, at least that I'm aware of, which is the swoon theory, which says that Jesus never really died at all. He merely went into a coma on the cross, and then he resuscitated in the tomb. So let's say, for the sake of argument, that that happened. That Jesus didn't die on the cross, in spite of the fact that it is a universally accepted fact. Let's say that maybe that's true. He didn't die. So this theory then would have us believe that after being beaten, and not just beaten a little bit, but being beaten to the point that kill some people, after being beaten to this extent and crucified and stabbed through the lungs with a spear, after all of that, he lies in a cold, stuffy tomb wrapped in some 100 pounds of spices and cloth, based on the Jewish burial custom, breathing cold, stale air. Over that 36-hour period, he has no food, no drink, no medical attention. Somehow he manages to get himself out of this wrap and spices. He pushes away a 1 to 2 ton stone, possibly uphill. And then in that condition, after all of those things, having gone through all of that, he fights off trained Roman guards, because surely he couldn't have moved that stone without them noticing. Then he walks for miles on pierced feet to where the disciples are, and somehow convinces them that he is the conqueror of death in that condition. Now, is this really any easier to believe than the resurrection? And then what happens to Jesus after this point? Here is someone who made every history book that there was. He made the Jewish history, he made the Roman history, he made Christian history, and then he vanishes? He goes into hiding after this point? And what about the disciples? Were they fooled? Were they gullible and dumb enough to believe that someone in this condition actually conquered death, and then they go out and they die for a liar? Or do they play along and willingly die horrific deaths for what they knew to be a lie? Well, this theory doesn't answer anything either. Mostly, it doesn't answer what is a universally accepted fact, which is that Jesus died by crucifixion. It might explain Jesus' appearances to the disciples. It might explain why Paul and James would have been converted, but they would have had to be just as dumb as the disciples were for it to explain that. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle said through his famous detective, "Whenever you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable it may be, must be the truth." Now understand, if all we did was build straw men up and tear them down, then we wouldn't have accomplished much of anything this evening in terms of eliminating the impossible. But what we've looked at this evening are the five best theories that the greatest minds of science and philosophy have come up with in the last 2,000 years to explain away the testimony. And none of these even can explain the minimal facts of the resurrection, much less the rest of the stuff we didn't look at this evening. Well, what remains then? We've eliminated the impossible. What remains is the resurrection of Jesus. It may seem unlikely, it may seem improbable, but it is the one thing that there is that explains all of the evidence that there is. It is the good reason that we have for believing in God. And it is something that we can hang our hope in any other time there's a question that we don't know the answer to. God rose Jesus from the dead, so I can take a step of faith out knowing that He is there. And obviously we don't have time this evening to discuss all of the, theological implications of the resurrection. But I do want to end this evening by pointing to one thing that the resurrection teaches us. As Paul is teaching in Acts chapter 17, there in Athens, as he is reasoning with the philosophical elite, as we have already discussed this evening, he says in verse 30, "The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now He commands all people everywhere to repent, because He has fixed a day on which He will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom He has appointed, and of this He has given assurance to all by raising Him from the dead." You know, that's something that I don't know that I really thought of much when I was growing up. That's one of those verses I've read 100 times without really picking up on the significance of it. The resurrection of Jesus assures us that God will judge us. It tells us unquestioningly that there will be a judgment day. In the Old West, sometimes a brush fire would come on the land, and it would come rushing across the land with a wind behind it, moving so fast that you couldn't outrun it. And if you got on your horse and went the other way as fast as you could, you still couldn't outrun it. It was going to catch you and it was going to kill you, and there was basically nothing that you could possibly do. Except what they would do is they would take a stick from the fire and light a fire where they stood to burn out in the other direction and burn out to meet the fire coming at them. And then they would follow that fire as it burned out, and they would stand on what was now scorched ground. And as the fire came up to them, it would find nothing left to burn because all that ground had already been burnt, and it would pass around on the outside, and they would be safe there on that scorched ground. Our God is a consuming fire. And He will pour out His wrath on those who have transgressed against Him. And you cannot outrun this judgment. You can't do enough good things so that God will look at you and say, you don't deserve this judgment. There is, however, one solution. In Romans chapter 5, while we were still weak, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one will dare even to die. But God shows His love for us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since therefore we have now been justified by His blood, much more shall we be saved by Him from the wrath of God. Judgment is coming. The fire of God is coming, and it will burn up this world, and it will burn up all wickedness. And there's nothing that we can do to get away from it. There is, however, a place where the ground has already been scorched. There is a place where God's wrath in its fullness has already been poured out. And it was on Jesus when He hung on the cross. There is one place of safety that we can stand when the judgment of God comes. And it is if we stand at the cross. We let Jesus take the wrath for us. And that is our only recourse. And so the question for us this evening is, do we believe in God? And if so, have we taken our stand at the cross? Have we died with Jesus so that we may raise with Him? If there's anything that we can do this evening to help you, won't you come while we stand and sing?
Jesus is calling, calling for you and for me. See on the portals He's waiting and watching, watching for you and for me. Come home, come home, ye who are weary, come home. Earnestly, tenderly, Jesus is calling, calling, O sinner, come home. Why should we tarry when Jesus is pleading, pleading for you and for me? Why should we linger and heed not His mercies, mercies for you and for me? Come home, come home, ye who are weary, come home. Earnestly, tenderly, Jesus is calling, calling, O sinner, come home. Oh, for the wonderful love He has promised.